Welcome to Ideas in Development, a VoxDev podcast on economic policy and research. I'm Oliver Hanney, the managing editor here at VoxDev. So far in our series of podcasts on AI, we've talked a lot about the big picture, whether the Industrial Revolution is a good comparison, how AI could upend labour markets, and how Africa can make sure that it's AI ready. But what about the here and now? In this episode, we're going to zoom in and talk to three people implementing AI solutions on the ground. In each of these profiles, we're going to cover how AI is helping to tackle problems and improve lives in India. We start in India's courtrooms, for which we are joined by Utkarsh Saxena. Welcome to Ideas in Development. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a bit about your organization, the problem that you're trying to solve, and how AI helps you solve it?
Sure. So the organization is called Adalat AI. Adalat means courts in multiple Indian languages, and AI, of course, is AI. So it's AI for courts. And we are a legal tech social venture that's building technology and AI solutions for courtrooms to help them expedite the processing of cases and reduce delays and backlogs in the system. The problem statement is there are 50 million cases stuck in courts. It's going to take us 300 years to clear the backlogs per some estimates. And this inflicts multiple challenges for economic development and growth, contract enforcement, property rights, and also human rights. India's prison population comprises of 70 to 80% under trials who are not in jail serving a sentence, but just trapped there waiting for their bails to be heard. And so the idea is to address this problem head on. We're going to do this with AI solutions that address manual and clerical pain points in the system. Courts in India and much of the global south are still very paper-based. Everything is handwritten. There are processes that take time to find the right document, calendar the cases correctly. And so we are building a series of end-to-end solutions that automate and expedite these clerical pain points to reduce delays. To make this come a little bit more alive, I'll highlight a specific problem. So for example, in India's courts, there aren't enough stenographers. And stenographers have the important responsibility of writing everything down in a court, because in a court of law, everything needs to be written down. The oral arguments, the cross-examinations, the orders and judgments. So without stenographers, the judges actually do this by hand. Every day, they're not judges as much as they're scribes, and that takes a lot of time, affects the quality of decision-making. Cross-examinations don't take hours, but take weeks, because everything is being handwritten and witnesses keep getting called back. So Adalat AI built an AI-powered legal transcription tool that understands legal jargon, the Latin expressions we love using in courts, case law, statutory provisions, transcribes them in multiple Indian languages in real time in a court to ensure that we can expedite the throughput of recording of evidence or oral arguments and reduce the time for these intermediate deliverables.
And how exactly did you end up kind of founding Adalat AI and working on this area in particular?
Well, I'm a lawyer by training. I finished law school. I was young and idealistic, and I said cheesy things like, I'm going to fight for justice. And then I reached a courtroom and I got a rude reality check because the court systems were broken, and saw these experiences firsthand. I spent more time in the court record room trying to find the right document for my cross-examination than the next week than actually preparing for the cross-examination next week. And so it was these personal experiences. I was also a law clerk on the Indian Supreme Court, so I saw the administrative burdens that exist even on a Supreme Court justice who have staff and team members. Forget the magistrates in the local courts who struggle with significantly lower resources and with much lower state capacity. And so kind of all these experiences made me think a little bit about how can we address these challenges. I also have a background in international development and development economics. So all these inspiring nonprofit organizations that help build capacity in public schools to improve educational outcomes, to build capacity in public hospitals to improve health outcomes. But where are the nonprofits that work directly with public courts to improve justice delivery, which is also an important form, a part of our governance system? And that's how Adalat AI was born.
And how do you plan to test the impact of the platform or kind of tool that you're building?
Because this came out of academia, I was a PhD student at Oxford and a fellow at MIT when this was born. It was incubated at both universities. We're doing randomized controlled trials in partnership with J-PAL to quantify the effects. In the beginning, we're focusing a little bit more on direct judicial and legal outcomes. So treatment courts that get the technology solutions, how does it affect the number of cases they clear, the number of witnesses they record in a date, the daily or weekly judicial output. The other variable we're also going to focus on is judicial quality, because the theory of change is that when you expedite these administrative tasks, you create a windfall of time, which allows the judges to focus on more critical things like reading case law, reading scholarship, writing judgments and opinions, which hopefully also improves the quality of the opinions and decision-making that's coming out of court. So the first set of RCTs is going to focus much more on these legal and judicial outcomes. But down the road, we also want to study downstream effects, because there is so much economic literature, primarily on the theoretical side or from the global north, on the impact of courts on property rights, dispute resolution, credit markets, a series of economic development outcomes. And so we want to study downstream effects as well, how it affects firms that are trapped in litigation, their access to credit, households that are trapped in litigation, to study the larger spillovers from the judiciary on downstream sectors in developing countries.
And I guess part of your ambition then over the coming years is to kind of test all of these different hypotheses and the actual kind of impact that your tool's having. What other ambitions does Adalat AI have in the coming years?
Well, I think two big ones. One, we want to build an end-to-end tech stack that automates all the clerical processes in a courtroom to kind of make them paperless and digital. So for example, right now our solutions are court-facing. They're not public-facing or lawyer-facing. But our next generation of solutions is going to focus on that. And I'll give you an example. One of the biggest tragedies in the Indian court system is that all lawyers draft their petitions on their computers, on a text editor, and then we all print them out, make them physical, and then go file them in a courtroom. And then the entire judiciary apparatus spends time and money and resources to digitize this physical document, which was originally electronic. And so we are building paperless filing systems so that lawyers can file these documents from their computers. And all the time and effort that goes into scanning them, OCR scanning them, making them searchable, making them easy to navigate is completely eliminated so that you can do a simple control F on documents, which is a big part of a lawyer's job. So I think the idea is to expand the stack from beyond the courtrooms to lawyer-facing solutions as well. I think the second big ambition is, you know, when we started this, our work was focused primarily on India because I'm a lawyer from India. My co-founder, Orgo Bhattacharya, is the CTO, is an engineer from India. And we really were worried about, external validity and replication in other settings. But turns out many countries in the global south inherited the same broken justice systems from the shared from their shared colonial legacy. And so we are doing pilots in Kenya, Ghana, and Zambia. It's surreal to go to these courtrooms in Lusaka and Nairobi and sit in a courtroom at the back and understand exactly what's going on, because the same provisions, the same case law are still cited in these countries, and they're all in English. That we're also exploring how to partner with local organizations and court systems in other countries to make this a more global international solution for the global south.
That's super interesting. Has there been anything in particular that you've identified as maybe being a barrier to taking what you've been working on in India elsewhere? Or is it really something that does seem to just be suited to a lot of different contexts rather than just kind of something specific to India?
No, there is some heterogeneity in state capacity. So I think India has done pretty well with building digital solutions. DPI is a big thing in India now. And so the starting point for some of these tech solutions, India seems a little better off than other countries that we are seeing. And so we have to do a little bit more work to ensure that our solutions work even with low internet connectivity, right? With internet fluctuations or with low things like low display resolutions, because the kind of monitors they may have in the courtrooms are not very good. So there is some work required. But those are easier problems to solve than things like language, because that's what language models are trained on, or legal jurisprudence, or legal provisions, or just even like the broader common law framework, because that's shared. Those harder problems are already taken into account. And we have to work with other kind of state capacity variables to customize the solutions for different settings.
And one thing that at least I've thought about with AI and struggled with is, because the pace of change is so rapid and it seems like these models are improving so quickly, it can sometimes feel demotivating to try something yourself, because you kind of think to yourself, well, what's Claude or ChatGPT going to be able to do in 2 years? And how on earth would I be doing something that's better or more useful than that? I wonder how you've thought about that type of framing. Obviously, you probably have a more positive take on it because you've actually gone out and done it. But yeah, any thoughts you have on that would be great.
Yeah, so I think one caveat to set out at the outset is this is a sovereign function. We are working with courts. This is a highly confidential setting. And so we actually can't use GPT or Gemini or Claude because we can't send any data through third-party APIs to any external organizations. And so Adalat AI has its own models that it fine-tunes for this context, deploys them on our own GPUs, which obviously changes our unit economics substantially. But in terms of how I feel about the future, there are a couple of things that I think we think about a lot. The first is that everyone's talking about generative AI because that's what the consumer is using. But there's a lot of other aspects of AI that are extremely exciting and address some of the unique challenges in the global south. So for example, speech-to-text transcription is not as glamorous as generative AI, but the fact that you can now transcribe what is being said in your language, in your accents and dialects, is extremely powerful, not just for the legal context, but doctors transcribing in public hospitals, frontline workers in other settings as well. And so we are focusing much more on these other technologies like speech-to-text or even image-to-text, scanning technologies. How do you take all that legacy paper work in courtrooms and actually digitize them and make them searchable? So I think that's the first thing, those models unfortunately are not moving as quickly as the more generative AI solutions. The second is that even where there are Gen AI solutions, there are huge inequalities in kind of the commercial motivations here, because not as much work is happening in Indian languages, right? Our initial models came out in Malayalam, in Tamil, in Hindi, where there isn't that much work happening because there isn't that much money there. And so those aspects of work are neglected. And I would say more needs to be done there. And the pace is actually slower than what we would like. So just because of the nature of our setting, because of the kind of stakeholders we're addressing, the state capacity challenges, I think more needs to happen. The pace actually needs to be faster to reduce these inequalities and leverage this technology for kind of advancing development challenges. I will also say that this is just a means, and it's a limited means. It's, I think, people are trying to make it out to be a silver bullet, which we are deeply suspicious of. Adalat AI is a twin engine venture. Only one engine is all this AI, LLMs, kind of speech to text encryption work. The other engine of the venture is programming and partnerships. We actually have to work with the courts, the judges, the court staff, the frontline workers of the judiciary to enable them to embrace technology and use it in their daily workflow. That's a much harder problem sometimes, because the kind of doubts that we get from judges and court staff range from how do I update my Google Chrome browser, or how do I unmute my mic? Why is my speech to text not working? So in those settings, actually a lot more work needs to be done on building those partnerships with the actual stakeholders, training at the right level, meeting them where they are at, so that the technology is at the right level and is actually internalized in the workflows.
It's interesting that you mentioned there that you have had to kind of invest in your own GPUs. I'm wondering if you could expand a bit upon that and how much of a challenge that has posed to Adalat AI's mission.
Yeah, certainly. This is an extremely confidential setting. Stock markets can move with a judgment leak. You have to be extremely careful in these settings. And so we have three pillars to our security architecture. The first is the data is completely localized in India. So the data storage is all on Indian data centers. The second is that we don't use any third-party APIs, as I mentioned. We develop our own models. And the third is we have a very complicated encryption framework, which resembles blockchain a little bit, so that each encryption key is decentralized and stored on the local machines of the courts, so that we or you know anyone else doesn't have access to them. That means that we take off-the-shelf models, fine-tune them, right? Work with the courts to actually annotate data sets. So for example, suppose you have a complex legal phrase that you speak in Tamil, which needs to then be transcribed in Tamil. You have to work with linguists, the court staff, the judges to create these data sets, which you then feed the model. And that's human labor intensive, is time consuming, is expensive. And so that's a big part of our work as well. And then to actually deploy these models on our own GPUs completely changes the unit economics. It's almost 15 to 20 times more expensive to house your own models and to kind of run them on your GPUs because GPUs are expensive. So I think that's certainly part of the challenge. The other challenge, I think, is a little bit more to think about what's the long-term plan here, because we are going for government adoption. Ideally, we are happy to build these solutions and run them for now in the short run, but the government should take over. Just like as the government built IT teams after the dot-com boom and had internal servers and websites and, you know, those kinds of teams, at some point they'll have AI teams as well. And so thinking about that transition also complicates it for us because it's not API-based. We need to build and invest in capacity in the courts, in the ministries, in the bureaucracies, so that they can actually run these models at scale and we can kind of be an R&D wing that helps develop new solutions and onboard them, a kind of like a build, operate, and transfer model. But the eventual operation is done by the courts in the long run. And the fact that it's our own models and our own GPUs certainly makes that harder, more challenging, and increases our responsibility to invest in training our stakeholders so that they can inherit these kind of workflows from us and then run them on their own.
And now, in India's classrooms, for which we are joined by Claire Cullen, welcome to Ideas in Development. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks so much.
So to start with, could you tell us a bit about your organization and the problem you're trying to solve and how AI is helping you to solve it?
Yeah, absolutely. So I work at Youth Impact, which is an evidence-based NGO that's scaling up evidence-based programs to youth around the world. And we have education and health programs. So we really do have evidence in our DNA. So we're either taking proven programs and scaling them up or generating our new evidence when necessary. So one of the problems that we're trying to solve is what's often referred to as the global learning crisis. So far too many kids graduate primary school without being able to operate numbers or to read. So they're illiterate or innumerate. And so one of the most evidence-based programs designed to target this problem is really to target instruction to the kid's individual level. So to identify what they know. Do they know addition, subtraction, multiplication, or letter, word, paragraph? And then target instruction to the level that they're at. And so we essentially are doing this in a phone-based one-on-one tutoring program. So we've run lots of trials of this in different countries, and we've seen a lot of evidence that it's really effective. And so in India, we're working with the state of Karnataka. And so they're really keen to kind of scale this program up, but one of the bottlenecks is teacher time. Teachers are very busy in school, in classrooms, so they don't have a lot of extra time to be tutoring kids after school. And so AI is helping us to kind of address this bottleneck of teacher time, but lots of demand. And so the AI is really complementing teachers by doing this quick diagnostic assessment, like assessing if kids know addition, subtraction, multiplication, division. They give that information to the teacher, who can then target instruction to the kids' level.
And how exactly did you end up kind of working on this in India, but then also working at Youth Impact as well?
I guess we ended up in the state of Karnataka because the government there has a great relationship with J-PAL, and J-PAL had come across our previous randomized control trial evidence and was keen to scale up evidence-based programs to address the learning crisis there. So that's specifically in Karnataka. And then how I ended up at Youth Impact, I previously worked in like governments and multilaterals and academia, but I was really keen to work kind of at the coalface of using evidence to have impact. And so I came across Youth Impact. It has like fantastic entrepreneurs. It's like a startup-y kind of environment. My colleagues are teachers or curriculum experts. And so evidence that I'm generating is seen by decision makers the next day and then used immediately to improve programs. So it's just super rewarding.
And going back to the work you're doing in India, is that something where you've already been able to see the impacts that you're having, or are there ways that you're planning to test how the work you're doing is impacting learning and addressing the learning crisis?
Yeah, so I guess it's still early days. So with this voice-to-voice AI bot, essentially, that's kind of assessing kids' levels, we're still developing the model. So we have a great partnership with OpenAI and Agency Fund and Center for Global Development, who are helping us to build the model. And then we're now in pilot stage. So we're trying it out. We've tried it out with a few hundreds of kids in Karnataka, as well as some other countries. We found so far in the early days, it works really well with kids in grades 4 and 5, but kids with a bit like softer voices in grade 3, maybe higher pitch, the model is not yet super good. It hasn't been clearly trained on younger voices. So we're both like collecting more voice data to train the model on. And then we find that in the interim, the solution can be that caregivers repeat the kid's answer. And so then it can pick up the adult's voice. And then, yeah, what's ahead, I guess. You've heard me talk about randomized control trials. We're obviously big believers in evidence. We're not going to scale something up unless we know that it's working. So for sure, down the road, we'll be doing more validation and checks of this to make sure it's working well.
And I guess that's part of your ambition over the coming years. Is there any other plans you have in terms of AI and education in India?
Yeah, I think for the time being, this is what we're really focused on, getting this right. I think there are a lot of key, like the model is one part of it, but there's a lot of other important infrastructure and relationships that need to be built to scale this kind of thing up. So I think we're really keen to nail those down. And then, yes, we're working in a lot of other countries with really large populations, large demand, and teacher time is a constraint pretty universally. So I think if this works in Karnataka, there's other states in India that are keen, other countries that would be keen as well.
And from how you were describing the work you're doing, the model is enabling you to establish what level kids are at. And then are you also going to be trying to use AI to then, once you've established the level they're at, target instruction to them? Or is it mainly for that first stage of figuring out what level people are at?
For now, it's the assessment, but in theory, it could certainly apply to tutoring. I do. So for now, it's a great complement to teachers because they're already busy in the classrooms. And so the assessment piece saves them 25% of their time if they're not having to do baseline and endline assessments of kids' progress. But tutoring is, all the evidence on EdTech does suggest that it is really helpful in hyper customization and hyper targeting. And so it's so good at having a really heterogeneous classroom where everybody is a very different level, and then hyper-targeting instruction to that kid's level. So AI is a perfect case. It's kind of like designed for heterogeneity. And we find in our studies of these programs to date, there's like no heterogeneous treatment effect, actually. It's just as effective for a kid at addition level as a kid at division or multiplication level.
And one question I'm asking is how future-proof you think this is. I guess one thing that might put people off starting something new with AI is if they look at the progress that's been made by the kind of big labs and the main models and kind of think to themselves, well, I mean, what's the point in me starting something today? Because the next model in a year's time will be able to do exactly what I'm trying to do now. I wonder how Youth Impact has been thinking about that, whether you have any thoughts.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I'd assumed that the model was the hard part, but actually I think it's a lot of the like human pipeline infrastructure relationships part that's hard. And so certainly the AI model is not that easy, but really what we're doing is investing a lot of time in like building relationships with governments, building trust with households, building a good product that households want to pick up the phone for, making sure that the curriculum is teaching place value in the right way, that place value is taught in India, making sure it's working with the Canada language. So lots of these things are kind of, it's a bit model agnostic. And so if a new model came that was much better than this one, it would be easy enough to change that because the pipeline of trust and relationships and figuring out the phone connectivity has already been sorted. So that makes me confident. And I think another thing that really does help is that Youth Impact has kind of like, I've talked about the evidence being baked into our DNA, but we run A-B tests on all of our programs every school term all the time. And so that kind of like culture of learning and iteration does mean that we're like constantly horizon scanning. We can see if something better is out there. It's easy to swap in or out new ideas and innovations and test them quickly. So I think that also really helps with the future proofing.
And in terms of how context specific the work you've been doing on this specifically is it something you see as being easily transferable to other places, or does all of that work you were just talking about of kind of building relationships, etc., mean that wherever you do this, it's going to be a bit of a challenge at first to get it going?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think probably the latter is like that stuff, relationship building takes a long time. So fortunately, we already have relationships built in a lot of countries where we've got trust with governments and teachers and households. So I think that will help entry in new places. Because that like human pipeline does take a while to build. And then the tech part is probably a little bit more easily interchangeable. But I guess helpfully the foundation of this program is so universal and so tested. Targeted instruction, one of the most cost-effective education interventions with RCTs all around the place. So the fundamentals are like pretty universal. Teacher time is a constraint everywhere. As long as you're building solid relationships in new places, I think it's quite scalable still.
And in terms of like thinking about how this would scale, is that something you are already doing at this stage, or is it very much kind of like sequential where, we figure out if this works first and then we think about scaling, or are you already kind of trying to think about how this might scale if it does seem to be effective?
Yeah, so I guess if scaling is such a fun thing we could talk about for everyone. I guess, so we're like the government of Karnataka had this chat with JPL, and then they allocated money in the budget and decided they wanted to scale up to all the kids in the state in grade 3, 4, 5 immediately. So the human teacher intervention is happening simultaneously, which gives us like great sense of how it's going, building relationships with teachers, finding problems. And then this development is kind of tinkering and happening on the side. And then we're layering it in as we're getting more confident that it's working to support teachers. So it's lots of, I guess, scaling is lots of like tinkering, trying it out, adapting, but seeing this window of opportunity when the government was so keen on an evidence-based program. So kind of like not wanting to miss the boat. So it's a bit of happening in parallel and tinkering at the same time is pretty rapidly scaling.
And we now find ourselves in India's farmers' fields, and we are joined by Niriksha Shetty, who is the CEO of Precision Development. Welcome to Ideas in Development. It's great to have you on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So to get started, would you be able to tell us a bit about your organization and the problem you're trying to solve and how AI is helping you to solve it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'll start with talking about PXD and the problem we're trying to solve and, you know, then get to the piece around AI. So as, you know, most of us know, more than 2 billion people live in smallholder farming households. A majority of them live in poverty. And I think, you know, as these are also the people that are hit hardest by changing climate patterns, by weather variability and so on. Today, there are innovations that can help them. You know, there are better seeds, there are better weather forecasting models, there are better, you know, finance models. But often these are not accessible to most farmers, or they don't reach them in ways that are actually useful or usable. That's the problem PXD is trying to solve. So we see ourselves as the bridge between smallholder farmers and the innovations they need. So most of the work we've done has been sort of providing evidence-based, cost-effective information at scale to farmers through their mobile phones, with the goal of improving their incomes and their resilience. A good example of this is with the state government of Odisha, an eastern state in India. We built a voice-based advisory service that reaches about 7 million farmers in the state with actionable guidance when they need it in ways that they can actually use it. So then to the second part of your question, which is how is AI helping us? It's been particularly transformative when we think about the cost effectiveness of our services at scale. I'll share two examples of how we're using AI. First is in actually improving the relevance of the information we're providing farmers. So AI models now are predicting critical events like the onset of the monsoon, not just better, faster, and cheaper, but with much longer lead times. And so, you know, for farmers, expectations of weather is one of the most critical pieces of information that they need to make decisions that can really impact their livelihoods and their incomes. Things like, you know, what to grow, how much to grow, when to borrow, how much labor to invest, and so on. So last year, we worked with several partners to disseminate AI-based monsoon onset forecasts to 38 million farmers across India, really influencing a key decision that they could make. And if you get that wrong, you know, for farmers, that can be devastating. So more broadly, we're excited about how AI can help us identify better information, you know, more relevant information that we can share with farmers. The second way we're excited about the possibility of using AI is on the side, on the delivery side. So for a long time when we were, you know, delivering advice to farmers, groups of agronomists, behavioral experts, data scientists would sit together and think about, you know, how to customize the information to different farmer groups. And, you know, you can imagine that's quite costly and resource intensive to scale. We're now using Gen AI to actually generate personalized advice at scale, from everything, including the content generation and personalization, but also the audio recording, the local language translation, and so on. And so we've done well. We're sort of really excited about this possibility of being able to generate hundreds and thousands of localized messages that are tailored to farmers' individual constraints, that are, you know, that learn from how farmers engage with our systems and that provide sort of real-time localized advice to farmers at scale.
And how did you end up in your role at Precision Development?
It's a long-winded story. So many, many years ago, I was a research associate supporting some of the early randomized control trials of digital advisory services in India. So I used to work with Professor Sean Cole at Harvard Business School, who is one of the co-founders of PXD. At that time, you know, this was pre-AI, pre-smartphones, but sort of the moment feels very similar because everyone was so excited about the sort of promise of the rapid expansion of mobile phones and the possibility of getting information in the hands of farmers. And so the evidence we found from these trials in India and Africa was actually quite compelling. That's where PXD grew out of those trials. And so I actually helped set up the first office in India way back when. I then came back in 2018 to run the India office and over time have sort of held several roles at PXD, and I took on the role of CEO last April. And I think a lot of that still feels very compelling, you know, the promise of cost effectiveness and scale. And with the advent of AI, it feels like, you know, it's just even more exciting in terms of what we can achieve with the goals we've set out for ourselves.
And if we're thinking specifically about the kind of advisory kind of work that you're doing using Gen AI, have you been able to track the impact of that yet? Or is it still kind of in the early stages where you're still testing how it works, what impacts it's having?
So I think that's, you know, exciting for me in terms of how PXD uses AI is we're using it on services that have already been tested rigorously for impact. So we have several RCTs on digital ag advisory that show sort of the cost effectiveness and impact at scale. You know, a recent study from the service I was mentioning in Odisha shows that, you know, these services are generating $12 to $19 in farmer returns for every dollar invested in the service. They're significantly helping reduce crop loss and climate vulnerability when farmers face extreme weather shocks. And so the way we're using AI is to both make that advice more personalized and therefore increase the impact, and also to make the process of generating that advice cheaper and cost effective. So testing, you know, changes to our service, new technologies, this ongoing iteration is core to what PXD does. And so the same applies for AI-based advisory. We're actually seeing from early results, you know, when we compare the AI-generated advice to the human-recorded and generated advice, that farmers are actually engaging a lot more with the AI-generated advice. And that's quite exciting, even just from these early results, as you think about the possibility of scale. So next, we're measuring sort of, you know, how it affects recall and knowledge. And then over time, the idea is to generate evidence across multiple settings on how that might influence yields and incomes and livelihoods more broadly.
And how much work did it take to get, I guess, whatever Gen AI tool you started with to the point where it was kind of just as good as the typical kind of digital advice you were giving? Was it relatively easy, or did it take kind of a lot of work giving it kind of context, language sort of cues?
So we started testing this in the coffee setting with coffee farmers in India. And so we've over time, you know, we have content and systems that we've built to figure out what information is useful. We've provided, you know, the more traditional digital agricultural advice for several years. So part of that, you know, there was a good knowledge and content base to sort of start from, and I think that helps. There's a lot of work required in the iteration and the testing. So, you know, things like the Gen AI would produce audio that was not, you know, the accent wasn't particularly great when you started out. It doesn't do well with numbers, as an example. So when you're recommending, say, fertilizer quantity, and the numbers are wrong, that can be pretty alarming. So I think both setting the guardrails for what works well and what doesn't. But I think, again, like going back to PXD's approach, sort of that constant testing and feedback loop with farmers, I think is critical. And then the way we're using it is to like support our teams of agronomists, push this advice at scale. And so there's still that human in the loop element. And so, you know, I imagine as we go to new geographies, the approach and the playbook and the underlying systems will remain the same, but we'll need to do sort of both some amount of identification to figure out, you know, what's the right model, what type of content and so on. But then also the actual testing and iteration with farmers to figure out, you know, does the language work? How can we tweak this to make it better? What sort of personalization works at scale and what doesn't?
Great. And in terms of your ambition over the coming years, I guess, is it just to try and scale this to as many people as possible? Are there other kind of applications you can see for AI in the agriculture space in India?
Yeah, we're excited about, you know, we're trying to get 100 million farmers by 2030, you know, providing them with high quality information. And I think there are three pathways for us in doing that. So one, and at least two of those will critically require AI. One is trying to figure out what sets of information and content can we get out to them, and can we use AI to identify or better predict those events that can influence farmers. The second is on the delivery side. So like I said, you know, what type of personalization? Is it one way? Is it two way? As more and more farmers get smartphones, how do you build that loop in? So this is sort of one instance of what we're trying to do, and it's sort of we've prioritized where we think we can get to scale fastest. But over time, you could imagine even more interaction, even more visualization in ways of engaging with farmers. I do want to say that, you know, underlying all of that is the institutional ecosystem that we need to build to facilitate the scale. And so a big part of that is building the, you know, partnerships with governments and other experts to actually get this information out at scale. And I think that is true sort of with or without AI.
And one question I've been asking people is, given that kind of AI is progressing so rapidly, it can sometimes feel off-putting and almost just encourages people to wait and not take chances, because you can just assume that, okay, AI is going to be able to do this in 2 years. Why would I bother trying to do something now? I was wondering kind of what your view is on that train of thought and whether you think that holds with what you've been doing in India.
I actually think the opposite. So for us, you know, the technology change strengthens the case for what we do. So the faster AI progresses, the more exciting it is for us. And part of that is for, you know, as PXD, technology has only been one part of the problem, and it's often not the hardest part of the problem. We're trying to figure out, you know, why farmers are not adopting profitable practices, and how can we build the systems for them to do that. And so that requires us to understand that entire ecosystem, right? It's like, what's the right content? Who are the right partners? What's the right delivery channel? Even things like, what's the right messaging or framing? And so if and when, and I assume technology will continue to get better, you know, and cheaper, that's really exciting to us, because it means the content gets better, the translation gets better, the delivery gets better. I think the critical part is that we're not anchored to a particular technology or a particular model. We're building these systems in a way that we can quickly test what works. You know, we can do things like A-B testing, iterative learning, to rapidly figure out what works, what's not working, and scale that. And so, you know, for us, it's not really about how quickly is the technology going to evolve? It's like, can we put the systems in place to actually get these technologies to scale as they get better? And so I think it's a really nice complement to how technology is evolving. And it sort of serves our goal of reaching as many farmers as we can with useful advice.
Great. And precision development doesn't only work in India, right? So I was wondering if this kind of work you've been doing in India is something you see as applicable to other contexts. If that's also part of your plans?
Yeah, absolutely. We're already starting to think about expansion in Nigeria and Ethiopia. And also, you know, across India. We've started in coffee in one particular setting, but we want to do several other value chains and several other types of information. And so that's very much part of sort of our expansion roadmap. And in each of those contexts, you know, the details will be different. So the crops and the information and the tools, or even the language models we use. But I think it's this like core approach of like, you know, figuring out what farmers need, figuring out the right content, experimenting and sort of isolating what works and what doesn't, and then scaling it through local partners. I think that will remain the same. And so we're sort of trying to build this playbook for how we do this in multiple geographies.
This has been Ideas in Development. If you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5 stars or a thumbs up wherever you've been listening or watching. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, all episodes can be found at voxdev.org.